She did not know she did it. I am a fool. And he resolved to forget it all, and to control his mind more sternly against such thoughts, for he truly did not welcome them. So through the months of that last spring, Yuan lived in a strange, double way. Within himself he held a certain place of his own, secure against this woman. The softness of the new season, the mildness of a moonlight night when he and she might walk together down the street under the budding new-leaved trees, into lonely roads leading to the country, or the stillness of a room where sometimes they sat alone, while the musical, steady rains of spring beat upon the window panes. Even such hours alone with her could not break through into that place. And Yuan wondered at himself, not knowing how he could be so stirred as he sometimes knew he was, and yet not want to yield. For in some ways this white woman could stir him and yet hold him off, and by the same things he loved and did not love. Because he loved beauty and never could escape it, he often saw her beautiful, her brow and neck so white against her dark hair. And yet he did not love such whiteness. He often saw her lighted eyes, clear and gray underneath her dark brows. And he could admire the mind which made them shine and flash. And yet he did not love gray eyes. So, too, with her hands, quick, vivid, speaking, moving hands, beautiful and angular in strength. But he did not love such hands, somehow. Yet he was drawn to her again and yet again by some power in her, so that over and over in that busy spring he would pause in the midst of his work in fields or in his room, or in the hall of books, to find her suddenly in his mind. He came to ask himself at such times, "Shall I miss her when I go away? Am I bound somehow to this country through this woman?" He dallied with the thought that he might stay on and study more, and yet he could ask himself plainly, "Why do I really stay? If in truth for this woman, to what end, seeing I do not want to wed one of her race?" Yet he felt a pang when he thought further, "No, I will go home." Then he thought further that perhaps he would never see her again, once he was gone. For how could he return again? When he thought he might never see her again, then it seemed he must indeed put off his going. Chapter 19. So might the questioning have dragged itself into an answer, and he stayed on. Except there came across the sea news which was like his country's voice demanding him. Now these years, while Yuan had been away, he had scarcely known how his country did. He knew that there were little wars, but to these he paid no heed, for there had been always little wars. In these 6 years Wang the Tiger wrote him of one or two such petty wars he undertook, one against a little new bandit chieftain, and a second time against a lord of war who passed unbidden through his regions. But Yuan passed quickly over such news, partly because he never loved wars, and partly because such things seemed not real to him at all, living in this peaceful foreign country. So that when some fellow pupil called out blithely, "Say, Wang, what's this new war you're getting up in China? I see it in the papers. Some Chang or Tang or Wang." And Yuan, ashamed, would answer quickly, "It is nothing, no more than any robbery anywhere." Sometimes his lady mother, who wrote him faithfully once a season, said in her letters, "The revolution grows apace, but I do not know how. Now that Meng is gone, we have no revolutionists in our family. I only hear that at last from the south the new revolution breaks. But Meng cannot yet come home. He is there among them, for he has written so, but he dares not yet come home, even if he would, for the rulers here are afraid and still very bitter in their hunting of those like him." But Yuan did not lay aside wholly the thought of his own country, and as he could he followed all the news he could find of that revolution, and he seized eagerly on every little printed line which told of some change, such as, "The old calendar of the moon is changed to the new Western calendar." Or he read, "It is forbidden any more to bind the feet of women." Or he read, "The new laws will not let a man have more wives than one." And many such things he read in those days. Every change Yuan read with joy and believed, and all through he could see his whole country changing, so that he thought to himself and wrote to Sheng So also, When we go back next summer, we will not know our land. It seems not possible that so soon, in 6 short years, so great a change has been brought about." To which Sheng wrote back after many days, "Do you go home this summer? But I am not ready. I have a year or two yet I want to live here, if my father will send the money for it." At these words, Yuan could not but remember with great discomfort that woman who put Sheng's little poems to such languid, heavy music. And then he would not think of her. But he wished Sheng would hasten and go home. It was true he had not yet won his degree, although he had spent more time at it than he should. And then, troubled, Yuan thought how Sheng never spoke of the new things in their own country. But he excused Sheng quickly, because indeed it was not easy in this rich, peaceful land to think of revolutions and of battles for a cause, and Yuan did too forget these things often in his own days of peace. And yet, as he knew afterwards, the revolution was even then coming to its height. Surely in its old way, up from the south, while Yuan spent his days upon his books, while he questioned himself what he felt for this white woman whom he loved and did not love, the gray army of the revolution, in which Meng was, crossed through the heart of his country to the great river. There it battled, but Yuan, 10,000 miles away, lived in peace. In such great peace he might thus have lived forever. For suddenly one day the warmth between him and the woman deepened. So long they had stood where they were, a little more than friends, a little less than lovers, that Yuan had come to take it as a thing accepted that every evening for a while they walked and talked together after the old pair slept. Before these two they showed nothing, and Mary would have said very honestly to any question, "But there is nothing to tell. What is there between us except friendship?" And it was true there had never been a speech between them which others could not hear and wonder nothing at. Yet every night these two felt the day not ended unless they had been alone a little while together, even though each talked idly only of the day's happenings. But in this little hour they grew more to know each other's minds and hearts than by days of other hours. One night in that spring they walked thus together up and down between the rose trees planted by a certain winding path. At the end of this path there were clumps of trees, 6 elm trees once planted in a circle and now grown large and old and full of shadows. Within these shadows the old man had placed a wooden seat, because he loved to come and sit there for meditation. On this night the shadows were very black, because it was a night of clear moon and all the garden was full of light, except where the 6 elms grew. Once did the two pause within the circle of shadow, and the woman said half carelessly, "See how dark these shadows are. We seem lost once we step within them." In silence they stood, and Yuan saw with a strange, uneasy pleasure how clear the moonlight was, and he said, "The moonlight is so bright one can almost see the color of the new leaves, or almost feel the shadow cold and the moonlight warm," said Mary, stepping out again into the light. Yet again they paused when they had walked to and fro, and this time Yuan paused first, and he said, "Are you cold, Mary?" For now he spoke her name easily. She answered, "No," half stammering, and then, without knowing how it came about, they stood uncertain in the shadow, and then quickly she moved to him, touched his hands, and Yuan felt this woman in his arms, and his arms about her too, his cheek against her hair. And he felt her trembling and knew he was trembling. And then, as one, they sank upon the bench, and she lifted up her head and looked at him, and put up her 2 hands and held his head, her hands upon his cheeks, and she whispered, "Kiss me." Then Yuan, who had seen such things pictured in amusement houses, but never had he done it, felt his head drawn down and her lips hot against his lips, and she was pressed and centered on his lips. In that instant he drew back. Why he must draw back, he could not tell, for there was that in him too which wanted to press on and on, deeper and long. But stronger than that desire was a distaste he could not understand, except it was the distaste of flesh for flesh that was not its own kind. He drew back and stood up quickly, hot and cold and shamed and confused together. But the woman sat on, amazed. Even in the shadow he could see her white face upturned to him, amazed, questioning him why he drew back. But for his very life he could say nothing, nothing. He only knew he must draw back. At last he said, half above his breath and not in his usual voice, "It is cold. You must go into the house. I must go back." Still she did not move, and then after a little time she said, "You go if you must. I want to stay here a while." And he, feeling himself somehow lacking in what he should have been, yet knowing he had done only what he must do, said in attempted courtesy, "You must come in, you will be chilled." She answered deliberately, without moving at all, "I am chilled already. What does it matter?" And Yuen, hearing how cold and dead her voice, turned quickly and left her there, and went away. But hour after hour he could not sleep. He thought of her only, and wondered if she still sat there in those shadows alone, and he was troubled for her, and yet he knew he had done only what he must. Like any child, he muttered to excuse himself, "I did not like it. I truly did not like it." How it might have been between them after that, Yuan did not know, for as though she knew his plight, his country now called him home. The next morning he awoke, knowing he must go to see Mary, and yet he delayed, half fearful, for now in the morning still there were these truths clear to him, that he had somehow failed her, though he knew he could have done no other thing than what he did. But when at last he went to the house, he found the three of them in great gravity and consternation over what they saw on a paper. The old man asked anxiously as Yuen came in with him, "Yuen, can this be true?" Yuen looked with them at the paper, and there in great letters were the words that the new revolutionists had fallen upon the white men and women in a certain city in his land, and had driven them from their homes and even killed some among them, a priest or two, an old teacher and a physician, and some others. Yuen's heart stopped, and he cried out, "There is a mistake here." And the old lady murmured, for she had sat waiting for his word, "Oh, Yuen, I knew it must be wrong." But Mary said nothing. Though Yuen did not look at her when he came in, and not now either, yet he saw her sitting there, silent, her chin resting on her crossed hands, looking at him. But he would not look at her fully. He read quickly down the page, crying over and over, "It is not true. It cannot be true. Such a thing could never happen in my country. Or if it did, there is some dreadful cause." His eyes searched for that cause. Then Mary spoke. She said, and now he knew her well enough to perceive her heart from the very way she spoke, her words clipped and clear and seemingly careless, her voice a little hard and casual, "I looked for the cause too, Yuen, but there is none. It seems they were all quite innocent and friendly people, surprised in their homes and with their children." At this Yuen looked at her, and she looked at him, her eyes as clear and gray and cold as ice. And they accused him, and he cried out to her silently, "I only did what I could not help." But they steadily accused him. Then Yuen, trying to be his usual self, sat down and, talking more than was his wont, said eagerly, "I shall call up my cousin Sheng. He will know, being in that large city, what the truth is. I know my people. They could not do a thing like this. We are a civilized race, not savage. We love peace. We hate bloodshed. There is a mistake here, I know." And the old lady repeated fervently, "I know there is a mistake, Yuen. I know God could not let such a thing happen to our good missionaries." But suddenly Yuen felt his breath stopped by this simple speech, and he was about to cry out, "If they were those priests!" But then his eyes fell on Mary again, and he was silent. For now she was looking at him still, and it was with a great speechless sadness, and he could not say a word. His heart longed for forgiveness from her, yet his very heart drew back, lest in seeking forgiveness it yield to that to which his flesh did not wish to yield. He said no more, and none spoke except the old man, who, when he was finished, said to Yuen as he rose, "Will you tell me, Yuen, what news you learn?" Then Yuen rose too, suddenly not wanting to be left alone with Mary, lest the lady leave them so. And he went away very heavy of heart, afraid, because he did not want the news to be true. He could not bear to be put to such shame, and this the more because he felt the woman judged him secretly for his withdrawal, and counted it for weakness in him. Therefore the more must he show his people blameless of this thing. Never again were these two near to each other. For as day passed into day, Yuen was swept into this passion to show his country clear, and he came to feel that if he could do it, he would be justified himself. In all the busy ending weeks of that year of school he so busied himself. Step by step he must prove it not his country's fault. It was true, Sheng said, his voice coming calm and like itself across the wires that first day. It was true the thing was done. And Yuen cried back impatiently, "But why? But why?" And Sheng's voice came back so careless Yuen could almost see him shrug himself. "Who knows? A mob? Communists? Some fanatic cause? Who can know the truth?" But Yuen was in an agony. "I will not believe it. There was a cause, some aggression, something." And Sheng said quietly, "We can never know the truth." And changing, he asked, "When shall we meet again, Yuen? I have not seen you in too long. When do you go home?" But Yuen was able only to say, "Soon." He knew that he must go home. If he could not clear his country, then he must go home as quickly as he could finish what remained to be done. Thereafter he went no more into the garden, nor were there hours alone with Mary any more. They were friendly outwardly, but there was nothing to be said between them, and Yuen planned so he need not meet her. For more and more as he could not prove his country blameless, he turned, somehow, against these very friends of his. The old pair perceived this, and though they were still gentle with him always, yet they drew themselves a little apart, too, not blaming him at all, and sensitive to his distress, though not understanding it. But Yuen felt they blamed him. Upon his shoulders he carried the weight of all his country did. Now, as he daily read the papers and read of things that any army does in victory and marching through a vanquished country, he felt himself in agony. Sometimes he wondered about his father, for the army moved steadily towards the northern plains, everywhere victorious. But his father seemed very far away. Near, too near, were these gentle, silent aliens, to whose home he must sometimes still go, for they would have it so, who never spoke one word of what the papers said, sparing him all mention of what they knew must torture him with shame. And yet in spite of all their silence, they accused. Their very silence accused. The woman's gravity and coolness, the prayers of the old two, for sometimes before a meal to which they pressed him, the old man would say low and troubled words, and he would add to his thanks such words as these, "Save them, O God, who are thy servants in a distant land, who live in such peril of their lives." And the lady would add to it most earnestly her soft, "Amen." Yuen could not bear this prayer, nor this Amen, and he could bear it less because even Mary, who had warned him against the faith of the old pair, now bowed her head in new respect of them. Not, he knew, that she believed more than she did, but only because she felt the dangers against which they prayed. So was she leagued with them against him, or so he thought. Again Yuen was alone, and alone he worked to the year's finish, and to the hour when with the others he stood for his degree. Alone among them all, the single one of his own people, he received the symbol of his scholarship. Alone he heard his name mentioned for high honors. There were a few who came to give him congratulations, but Yuen told himself he did not care if they came or not. Alone he packed his books and clothes. At the last it came into his mind that the old pair were even glad to see him go, although their kindness did not change. And then Yuen, in his pride, thought to himself, "I wonder if they have been uneasy lest I wed their daughter, and so are glad to see me go." He smiled bitterly, and believed this so. And then, thinking of her, he thought to himself again, But I have this to thank her for. She saved me from turning a Christian. Yes, once she saved me. But once, too, I saved myself. Part 3 Chapter 20 Even as Yuan had loved and hated his father in his childhood, so now he left that foreign country loving and hating it. He could not but love it, however unwillingly, as anyone must love a thing beautiful and young and strong. He loved beauty, and so he must love the beauty of trees upon mountains, and of meadows free from graves of the dead, and beasts upon the land fed and healthy and content, and cities clean of human refuse. Then he did not love these very things, because if they were beautiful, he was not sure if there could be beauty in the bare hills of his own country. And he felt it wrong that the dead should lie in the good land of the living, so that their graves were in the midst of fields, and he remembered such things there. When he looked upon the rich countryside passing him in the train, he thought, "If this were mine, I would love it very well. But it is not mine." He could not somehow love wholly a beauty or a good that was not his. He could not like very greatly the people even who possessed this good which was not his. When once more he went upon the ship and turned to his own country again, he spent much time in questioning himself what gain he had from these 6 years away. He had gained, doubtless, in learning. His brain was stuffed with useful learning, and he had a small trunk full of notebooks and books of other sorts, and there was a long dissertation he had made himself upon a theme of the inheritance of certain strains of wheat. He had, moreover, little bags of seed wheat, which he had chosen carefully from other seeds he had planted himself in experiment, and he planned to put this seed into his own ground, and raise more, and then more until there was enough to give to others, and so might all harvests be improved. Such things he knew he had. He had more than this. He had some certainties. He knew that when he wed, the woman must be of his own flesh and kind. He was not like Sheng. For him there was now no magic in white flesh and pale eyes and tangled hair. Wherever his mate was, she was like him. Her eyes black as his, her hair smooth and straight and black, her skin the hue of his. He must have his own. For, ever after that night beneath the elms, the white woman whom in some ways he knew very well had become to him completely strange. She was not changed. She maintained herself day after day as she had always been, steady, courteous always, quick to understand what he said or felt, but a stranger. Their two minds might know each other, but their minds were housed in two different habitations. Only for one moment had she striven to draw near to him again. She went with him, and the old pair also, to see him at his train, and when he put forth his hand to say farewell, she held it for an instant, strongly, and her gray eyes warmed and darkened, and she cried in a low voice, "Shall we not even write to each other?" Then Yuan, never able to give pain for any cause, and confused by the pain in her darkening eyes, said, stammering,
"Yes, of course. Why should we not?"
But she, searching his face, dropped his hand, and her look changed, and she said no more, not even when the old mother broke in quickly, "But of course Yuan will write to us." Then again Yuan promised that he would write and tell them everything. But he knew, and as the train drew away and he must look at Mary's face, he saw that she knew also that he would never write and tell them anything. He was going home, and they were aliens, and he could tell them nothing. As though he cast aside a garment no longer to be used, he cast aside these whole 6 years of his life, except the knowledge in his brain and his box of books. Yet now, upon the ship, when he thought of the years, there was the unwilling love in his heart, because this foreign country had so much he would have, and because he could not hate these three, since they were truly good. But the love was unwilling because now he was turned homeward. He began to remember certain things he had forgotten. He remembered his father, and he remembered small crowded streets, not clean or beautiful, and he remembered the 3 days he had spent once in prison.
But against these things he argued thus, that in these 6 years the revolution had come about, and doubtless all was changed. Was not all changed? For when he left, Meng had been a fugitive, and now Sheng told him Meng was a captain in the army of the revolution, and free to go anywhere and everywhere. There was more changed, too, for on this ship Yuan was not the only one of his kind. There were a score or so of young men and women who returned to their own land as he did, and they all talked much together and ate together at the same tables, and they talked of all that was come about. And Yuan heard how old, narrow streets were torn away, and great streets, as wide as any in the world, were driven through the old cities, and how there were motor vehicles far in the country along country roads, and farmers rode in them who used always to plod afoot, or at best sit across an ass's back. And he heard how many cannon and how many bombing planes, and how many weaponed soldiers the new revolution had. And they told how men and women were equal in these days, and how it was against the new law to sell or to smoke opium, and how all such old evils were now gone. They told so many things Yuan had not heard that he began to wonder why he ever had those old memories, and he grew more than ever eager to be in his new country. He was glad of his youth in these days, and among these of his own kind he said one day as they sat at a table together, and his heart leaped within him when he spoke, "How great a thing it is that we are born now, when we may be free and do as we will with our own lives." And they all looked at each other, these young, eager men and women, and they smiled in exultation. And one girl thrust out her pretty foot and said, "Look at me. If I had been born in my mother's time, do you think I could have walked on 2 good sound feet like these?" And they all laughed as children do over some little joke of their own. But the girl's laughter had a deeper meaning in it than only merriment, and one said, "It is the first time in our people's history that we are all free, the first time since Confucius." And then a merry youth cried out, "Down with Confucius!" And they all cried, "Yes, down with Confucius!" And they said, "Let's put him down and keep him down, with all those old things which we hate, him and his filial piety." Then at other times they talked more gravely, and at these times they grew anxious to think and plan what they could do for country's sake. For there was not one of these companions of Yuan's who was not filled with yearning so to serve his country. In every sentence they made, the words country and love of country could be heard, and they seriously weighed their faults and their abilities and compared them to those of other men. They said, "Those men of the West excel us in inventiveness, and in the energy in their bodies, and in their dauntlessness to go ahead in what they do." And another said, "How do we excel?" And they looked at each other and took thought, and they said, "We excel in patience and in understanding and in long endurance." At this the girl who had thrust out her pretty foot cried impatiently, "It is our weakness that we do endure so long. For myself, I am determined to endure nothing. Nothing at all I do not like, and I shall try to teach all my countrywomen not to endure anything. I never saw any woman in the foreign country endure anything she did not like, and that is how they have come as far as they have." And one, who was a wag, cried out, "Yes, it is the men who endure there, and now it seems we must learn it, brothers." And then they all laughed together, as the young will laugh easily. But the wag looked secretly with admiration at the bold, pretty, impatient girl, who must have her own way. So did all these young men and women, and Yuan among them, pass the days upon the ship in the highest good humor and most eager expectation of their homecoming. They paid no heed to any except themselves, for they all were filled with the strength of their sureness of their own youth, and sufficient to themselves in their knowledge and zest to be going home again, confident each one that he was significant and marked for some special value and service to his times. Yet for all their pleasure in themselves, Yuan could not but see how the very words they used were foreign words, and how even when they spoke their own tongues, they must add words of a foreign sort to supply some idea they had, for which there was no suited word in their own tongue. And the girls were half foreign in their dress, and the men all foreign, so that if one saw another in the back, it could not be said what his race was. and every night they danced, man and maid together, in the way foreigners did, and even sometimes as shamelessly, cheek pressed to cheek, and hand put into hand. Only Yuan did not dance. In such small ways, he held himself apart even from these his own people when they did that which was foreign to him. He said to himself, forgetting he used to do it, "It is a foreign thing, this dancing." But partly he drew back because now he did not want to take one of these new women in his arms. He was afraid of them because they put out their hands so easily to touch a man, and Yuan was always one who feared a clinging touch. So those days passed, and Yuan wondered more and more what his country would seem to him after all these years. On the day when he was to reach it, he went alone to the front of the ship, and there watched the coming of the land. The land put forth its shadow into the ocean long before it could be seen. Into the clear, cold green of ocean water, Yuan looked down and saw the yellow line of clay, which was the earth the river tore away in its passing, through thousands of miles of land, and carried turbulently down to throw into the sea. There the line was as clearly as though a hand had drawn it, so that every wave was pushed back and held away. Yuan one moment saw himself upon the ocean, and the next moment, as though the ship had leaped a barrier, he looked down into swirling yellow waves and knew himself at home. When later he went to bathe himself, for the day was in the midst of summer and of great heat, the water rushed out yellow, and Yuan thought first, "Shall I bathe myself in it?" For at first it seemed to him not clean. Then he said, "Why should I not bathe myself in it? It is dark with the good earth of my fathers." And he did bathe himself and felt himself cooled and cleansed. Then the ship crept into the river's mouth, and there the land was on either side, stolid and yellow and low and not beautiful. And on it were the small low houses of the same color, and there was no making it beautiful, as though that land did not care if men found it beautiful or not. There it was, as it always was. Low yellow banks the rivers had laid to push the sea back and claim more for their own. Even Yuan must see it was not beautiful. He stood upon the decks among the many others of every race and kind upon the ship, and they all stood staring at this new country. And Yuan heard some cry, "It's not beautiful, is it? It is not as pretty as the mountains of other countries." But he would not answer anything. He was proud and thought to himself, "My country hides her beauty. She is like a virtuous woman who puts on sober clothes before strangers at the gates, and only within the walls of her own home does she wear colors and put rings on her hands and jewels in her ears." For the first time in many years, this thought shaped itself into a small poem, and he felt the impulse to write four lines down, and he drew out a little book he kept in his pocket, and instantly the verse was there, and this flying moment added its point of brightness to the exaltation of this day. Then suddenly out of the flat, grave country towers arose, and these towers Yuan had not seen when he went away, awakening as he had within a ship's cabin at night with Sheng. Now he gazed on them as strangely as all these other travelers did, and they rose glittering in the hot sunshine, tall out of the flatness, and Yuan heard a white man say, "I did not dream it was such a big modern city," and he marked with secret pride the respect in the man's voice, though he said nothing and he did not let his face move, but only leaned as he was upon the rail and looked steadfastly at his country. But even as this pride rose in him, the ship was docked, and instantly a horde of common men leaped on the ship, fellows from the wharf and docks who pressed about to find a little work to do, a bag or box to hoist upon their backs, or some such lowly task. And in the harbor small dinghy boats crept out into the hot summer sunshine, and in these boats beggars whined and held up baskets on long poles, and of these beggars many were diseased. Among these common fellows, too, many were half-naked for the heat, and in their eagerness for work they pressed rudely among the delicately gowned white women, their bodies grimed and sweating. Then Yuan saw those white women draw back, some afraid of the men and all afraid of dirt and sweat and commonness, and Yuan felt a shame in his heart, for these beggars and these common fellows were his own people. And here was the strangest thing, that while he hated these white, shrinking women very much, suddenly he hated the beggars and the naked common fellows too, and he cried passionately within himself, "The rulers ought not to allow these people to come out and show themselves like this before everyone. It is not right that all the world should see them first, and some never see any but these." He resolved he must set himself to right this wrong somehow, for he could not bear it. Small as it might seem to some, it was not small to him. Then suddenly he was soothed, for now he stepped from the ship, and he saw his mother there to greet him, and with her Eilon. There among many they stood, but in one look of his eyes Yuen saw with a great flush of pleasure that there was none among all the many who could compare to Eilon. Even as he gave greeting to his mother, and felt the joy of her steadfast hand against his, and the great welcome in her eyes and smile, he could not but see how the eyes of all from that ship turned to Eilon, and he was glad they had her to see, who was his own race and blood. She could wipe out the sight of all the poor and common men. For Eilon was beautiful. When Yuen had seen her last, he was still a boy, and he had not valued all her prettiness. Now, as they lingered on the docks, he saw Eilon truly could have stood among the beauties of the world and lost nothing. It suited her well that she had lost the kitten-like coquettishness of her young girlhood. Now, although her eyes were bright and quick, her voice as light and flexible as ever, she had learned somehow a softer, finished dignity, from out of which only sometimes her laughter sparkled forth. About her warm, lovely face, her short hair was black and smoothly shaped. She did not curl it as some do, but kept it straight and smooth as ebony and cut across her forehead. On this day she wore a long, straight, silver gown of newest fashion, high-collared, but the sleeve short to her pretty elbows, and it was shaped to her body, so that without a breaking line there flowed the smooth perfection of shoulder, waist, thigh, ankle. So Yuen saw her proudly, comforted for much by her perfection. There were such women as this in his own land. A little behind his lady mother there stood a tall girl, no more a child, but still not wholly maiden. She was not beautiful as Eilon was, but she had a clear and noble gaze, and if Eilon had not been by, she would have seemed fair enough, for though she was tall, she moved gracefully and well, and her face was pale and oval, and the black eyes wide and set truly beneath full, straight brows. Now no one thought in all the talk and welcoming laughter to say anything to Yuen of who she was, but even as he was about to ask the question, it came to him that she was the child, Mei Ling, who had cried out at the prison gate that day because she had seen him first. He bowed to her in silence, and she to him in the same way, though Yuen took time to know her face was one not easily forgotten. There was one other who was the storyteller whom Yuen remembered even still, the one surnamed Wu, against whom the lady had asked Yuen to guard his sister. Now he stood confidently among these others, very debonair in Western garb, a small mustache beneath his nostrils, his hair as waxed and black as though it had been polished so, and in his whole look a sort of sureness that he was where he had a right to be. This Yuen soon understood, for after the first cries of greeting and the bows were over, the lady took this young man's hand delicately and took Yuen's, and she said, "Yuen, here is the man who is to wed our Eilon. We have put off the wedding day until you came, for Eilon chose it so." Now Yuen, remembering very well how the lady felt against this man, wondered that she never wrote of this, and yet now he could say nothing here except kind things, and so he took the other's smooth hand and shook it in the new fashion, and he smiled and said, "I am glad I can be at my sister's wedding. I am very fortunate." And the other laughed easily and a little indolently, and he let his eyelids droop in a way he had, and he looked at Yuen and drawled out in English of a modish certain sort, "It is I who am fortunate, I am sure." And across his hair he passed his other hand, whose strange loveliness Yuen remembered, Now he saw it again. Yuan, not used to this speech, dropped the hand he held and turned away uncertainly. And then he remembered this man had been already wed to some other woman, and he wondered what more and resolved to ask his mother secretly how all this came about, since now nothing could be said. Yet when a few minutes later they all walked out to the street, to where the cars awaited them, Yuan could not but see how very fairly mated these two were, and each like their race, and yet somehow they were not, too. It was almost as though some old, sturdy, rooted tree had put forth exquisite blossoms from its gnarled and knotted trunk. Then the lady took Yuan's hand again and said, "We must go home, because the sun is so hot here, shining up from the water." And he let himself be led into the streets, and there were motors waiting for them. His lady mother had her own to which she led Yuan, still clinging to his hand, and Mei Ling walked on her other side. But Ailan stepped into a small scarlet motor shaped for two, and with her was her lover. In that glowing vehicle these two might have been god and goddess for their beauty, for the top of it was thrown back, and the sun fell full upon their black and shining hair, upon the faultless smoothness of their golden skins, and the brightness of the scarlet did not daunt their beauty, but only showed more clearly the flawless perfect shape and grace in which their bodies grew. And Yuan could not but admire again such beauty, and feel the pride of race rush to his heart. Why, never once in that foreign land had he seen clear beauty like to this. He needed not to be afraid to come home. Then, even as he gazed, a beggar writhed himself out of the gaping multitude who stood to see these rich folk pass, and he rushed to the lordly scarlet car, and laid his hands upon the edge of the door and clung there, whining the old cry of his kind, "A little silver, sir, a little silver!" At this the young lord within shouted very harshly, "Remove your filthy hands!" But the beggar continued to whine yet more earnestly, and at last, when he would cling so, the young man reached down and slipped from his foot his shoe, his western shoe, hard and leathern, and with its heel he struck down upon the beggar's clutching fingers, and he struck with all his force, so that the beggar murmured, "Oh, my mother!" and fell back into the crowd and put his wounded hands to his mouth. Then, waving his beautiful pale hand to Yuan, the young man drove off his car in a roar of noise, and the scarlet thing leaped through the sunshine. In the first days in his own country, Yuan let his own heart stay in abeyance until he could see in proportion what was about him. At first he thought with a relief, "It is not so different here. After all, my country is like all other countries of this day, and why was I afraid?" And indeed so it seemed to him, and Yuan, who had secretly feared to find that houses and streets and people might seem poor and mean to him, was pleased he did not find them so. This was the more true because in these years, while he had been away, the lady removed herself from the small house where she used to live into a good large house built in a foreign fashion. On the first day when Yuan came with her into it, she said, "I did it for Ailan. She felt the other house too small and poor to have her friends come to it. And I have done, moreover, what I said I would. I have taken Mei Ling to live with me. Yuan, she might be my own child. Did I tell you she will be a physician as my father was? I have taught her all he taught me, and now she goes to a foreign school of medicine. She has 2 more years to learn, and then she must work in their hospital for more years. I say to her, do not forget that for internal humors it is we who know best our own frames. Nevertheless, it cannot be denied that for cutting and sewing up again, the foreign physicians are best. Mei Ling will know both. And she helps me besides with my girl babes, whom I still find unwanted in the streets, and many of them these days, Yuan, after the revolution, when men and maids have learned to be so free." Yuan said, wondering, "But I thought Mei Ling only a child. I remember her only a child." "She is 20 years old," the lady answered quietly, "and very far past childhood. In mind, she is much older than that, and older than Ailan, who is 3 years more than 20. A very brave, quiet maid, Mei Ling is. I went one day and saw her help the doctor, who cut a great thing from a woman's neck, and her hands were as steady as a man's to do it, and the doctor praised her because she did not tremble and was not frightened by the gush of blood. Nothing frightens her. A very brave, quiet maid. Yet she and Ailan like each other, though she will not follow Ailan to her pleasures, and Ailan would not see the things that Mei Ling does. By now they sat in the lady's sitting room alone, for Mei Ling had gone away at once, and no one was near except the servant who brought tea and comfits in and out. And Yuan asked curiously, "I thought this Wu was bound to another wife, my mother." At this the lady sighed and answered, "I knew you would wonder. I have been through such a trouble with Ailan. Yuan, she would have him, and he would have her, and there was nothing to be said, no way to persuade her to anything. That was the reason why I took this greater house, because I thought if they must meet it might be here, since meet they would, and all that I could do was to fend off more, until he could divorce his old wife and be free." And it was true she was an old-fashioned woman, Yuan, one his parents had chosen for him and wed to him when he was 16. I do not know whom to pity most, the man or that poor soul. I seem to feel in me the sorrows of them both. I was wed like that too and not loved, and so I felt myself her. And yet I promised myself I would let my daughter wed where she would, because I know what it is to be not loved. And so it is that I feel the troubles of them both. But it is arranged now, Yuan, in the way such things are arranged, too easily, I fear, nowadays. He is free, and she, poor woman, returns to the inland city of her birth. I went to see her at the last, for she lived here with him, though not really, she said, with him. There she was, with her two maids, putting her garments in the red leathern boxes she had bought as part of her marriage portion. And all she said to me was, "I knew this end must come. I knew this end must come." A woman, not beautiful, and older by 5 years than he, speaking no foreign tongue, as all must speak these days, and even with her feet once bound, though she strove to hide this in big foreign shoes. For her, indeed, it is the end. What is left to her now? I did not ask. I must think most of Ailan now. We can do nothing in these days, we old ones, except let the new sweep us on as it will. Who can do anything? The country is upset, and anyhow, and there is nothing left to guide us, no rule, no punishment. Yuan only smiled a little when she ended thus. She sat old and quiet and always a little sad, her hair white, and she said the things the old always say. For in himself he felt only courage and hopefulness. In the day he had been back, in the hours even, this city somehow gave him courage. It was so busy and so rich. Everywhere, even in his quick passing, he saw great new shops were raised up, shops to sell machines, and shops to sell goods of every kind from all parts of the world. No longer were there many humble streets lined with the low-roofed simple shops of homely merchandise. The city was a center of the world, and new buildings heaped on buildings higher and higher. In the 6 years he had been gone, a score of mighty buildings had flung themselves up against the sky. That first night before he slept, he stood at the window of his room and looked out across the city, and he thought, "It looks almost like the city where Sheng is abroad." There about him were blazing lights, and the noise of motors, and the deep hum of a million humans, and all the rush and throb of restless, growing, pushing life. This was his country. The letters hung in flame against the moonless clouds were letters of his own tongue, proclaiming goods his own countrymen were making. The city was his own, and great as any in the world. He thought for a moment of that woman pushed aside to make way for Ailan. But he hardened himself as he thought, and in his heart he said, "So must all be pushed aside who cannot stand in this new day. It is right. Eilon and the man are right. The new cannot be denied. And in a sort of hard, clear joy, he laid himself to sleep. Chapter 21 Now Yuen went everywhere these few first days in this lift of joy through this great city. It seemed to him his fortune was good beyond his dreams, for he left this country from a prison, and now he was truly home again. And it seemed to him that all the prison gates were opened, not only his own prison, but all the bondages. It was an evil dream forgotten that his father had ever said he must wed against his will, and it was an evil dream that youths and maidens had once been seized and shot for seeking freedom. This freedom for which they died, why now it was achieved for all. Upon the streets of the city he saw the young come and go, their looks free and bold and ready to do what they would, men and women too, and there was no bondage anywhere. And in a day or two a letter came from Meng, which said, I would have come to meet you, but I am tied here at the new capital. We make the old city new, my cousin, and we tear down the old houses, and we have put up a great new road, which sweeps through the city like a cleansing wind, and we shall build more streets everywhere, and we have planned to tear down old unwanted temples, and put schools in them, for the people have no need of temples anymore in these new days. We teach them science instead. As for me, I am a captain in the army, and near to my general, who knew you once, Yuen, and that school of war. He says, tell Yuen there is a place here for him to do his work. And so there is, my cousin, for he has spoken to a man above him very high, and that one has spoken in a place of influence, and in the college here there is a place where you may teach what you like. And you can live here and help us to build this city. Then Yuen, reading these bold, swelling words, thought to himself with exultation, this is from Meng, who was in hiding, and see what he has come to. It was a warmth in Yuen, that already his country had a place for him. He turned it over in his mind a time or two. Did he indeed wish to teach young men and women? It might be the quickest way to serve his people. He put the thought into his mind, to wait a day or two or more, until his duty was fulfilled. For first he must go and see his uncle and his household, and then there was Eilon's wedding 3 days off, and then he must go to see his father. Yuen found 2 letters from his father waiting at the coast for him, and when he saw the square, trembling letters scrawled upon a page or two, big and uncertain as old men write, he was touched with an old tenderness, and he forgot he had ever feared or hated his father, for now on this new day the tiger seemed as futile as an old actor on a forgotten stage. Yes, he must go and see his father. Now if the 6 years had made Eilon more beautiful, and had led the child Mei Ling into womanhood, they had laid old age heavily upon Wang the landlord and his lady. For where Yuen's lady mother seemed to hold herself at much the same place all these years, her hair only a little whiter, her wise face a little more wise and more patient, and a little less round, these other two, Yuen found, were truly old. They lived now no more in their own house, but with their elder son, and thither Yuen went and found them, the house a western house the son had built, and set into a pleasant garden. In this garden the old man sat beneath a banana palm tree, and Yuen found him there, as placid and as happy as any aged saint. For now he had given up all his seeking, lustful ways, and the worst he did was to buy a picture now and then, wherein was painted a pretty maid, so that he had some hundreds of these pictures, and when he felt inclined he called to a servant that they be brought to him, and he turned the pictures over one by one and gazed at them. So he sat when Yuen came, and the maid-servant who stood beside him to fan off flies turned the pictures for him, as she might have turned pages for a child to see. Yuen scarcely knew him for his uncle, for this old man had by his very lustiness fended off his age until the last moment, so that whether it was because he now sometimes smoked a little opium, as the old will often do, or what it was, when his age was come at last upon him, it came as suddenly as a withering blast, shriveling him and driving off his fat, so that now he sat as loosely in his skin as though it were a garment cut too largely for him. Where his fat had stood out firm and full, folds of yellow skin hung down. His very robes he had not changed, and they also hung too loose upon him, very rich in textured satins, but still his old robes cut to suit his old fullness, and now gathered round his heels, and the sleeves falling over his hands, and the collar hanging to show his lean, wrinkled throat. When Yuan stood before him, the old man gave him vague greeting and said, "I sit here alone to look at these pictures, because my lady will have it that they are evil." And he laughed a little in his old, leering way. But it was ghastly laughter somehow on his ravaged face. And when he laughed, he looked at the maidservant, and she laughed with false heartiness to cheer him, while she stared at Yuan. But to Yuan, the old man's very voice and laughter seemed thinner than they used to be. And after a while, the old man asked again, while he still looked at his pictures, "How long is it since you went away?" And when Yuan told him, he asked, "And how does my second son?" And when Yuan told him, he muttered as though it were a thing he always thought when Sheng was in his mind, "He uses too much money in that foreign country. My eldest son says Sheng uses too much money." And he fell into a gravity until Yuan said to cheer him, "He returns next summer, he tells me." And the old man murmured, staring at another picture of a maid beneath a young bamboo, "Oh, aye, he says he does." Then he bethought himself of something, and he said suddenly with great pride, "You know my son Meng is a captain?" And when Yuan smiled and said he did, the old man said proudly, "Yes, he is a very great captain now, and he has a fine, large wage, and it is a good thing to have a warrior in the family somewhere in time of trouble. My son Meng, he is very high these days. He came to see me, and he wore a soldier's garb such as they wear abroad, they tell me, and he had a pistol in his belt and spurs to his heels. I saw them." Yuan held his peace, but he could not keep the smile from his face, to think how in these few years Meng had turned from a fugitive